So we'll now call upon our brother Nathan to deliver his study this evening, The Baskets, The Heaps of Heads.
Well, thanks, Brother Colin, and a very coolish evening to you all, brothers and sisters and young people. Seems to go from hot to a little chilly. Hopefully I can warm you up with the zeal of Jehu tonight. Well, we left Jehu this morning eating and drinking inside while the dogs ate outside. And the queen that had ruled the northern 10 tribes with an iron fist for 33 years lay abandoned, unattended to, unwanted in the street like a common criminal in the years of tyranny and fear. The persecution and darkness that had descended on the northern kingdom like a dark cloud was gone in a moment. And with that, well, that could be the end of the story for Jehu, don't you think? I mean, both kings lay dead. Jezebel's inedible parts are strewn in the fields outside Jezreel. You'd almost forgive him for thinking, well, I've fulfilled my commission, I'm calling it a day. But Jehu was a driven man. He was focused. He was a man who drove furiously for God. And he, in his mind, he had plenty of unfinished business. Oh, the element of surprise was now gone. His intentions were out in the open. Both kings were dead, and the queen was trampled. Everybody knew. Now he needed strategy. He needed to use some cunning. He needed a plan. And, you know, I don't know if it's like this for you, but it seems like it's a bit like this for me. It's a bit like elimination of evil in our own lives. There are the big, obvious things to cut out. The Jehorams, the Ahaziahs, the Jezebels. And maybe we just call it a day. But if we want to drive furiously for God, there are the smaller things. The niggly sins, the character defects that are smaller but keep plaguing us. Oh, we come on Sunday morning and everything's good, everything's fine. Eliminating evil seems easy. But when we come to Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, it's a lot more difficult and the small sins catch us out. And so now Jehu is going to recalibrate. He's got rid of the three great enemies, and he's going to refocus to complete the job in 2 Kings chapter 10. He doesn't have an army. He's just got a handful of loyal followers, and he's going to have to move quickly. And we read this in verse 1. Now, Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria, and Jehu wrote letters and sent to Samaria unto the elders of Jezreel, to the elders, to the rulers and to them that brought up Ahab's children, saying. Now, if you've got your handbook, this is slide, I think, 23 in your 25, sorry, in your handbook. It's the genealogy game. So just to get our bearings, these 70 sons on the genealogy are the 70 sons directly under Ahab and Jezebel. 70 sons in Samaria. Now, that's interesting, isn't it? What is the number 70? Well, the number 70 is the number of the Gentiles. You see, this family never really came into the truth, did they? They were basically Gentiles. Oh, they had a Jewish father, but that Syrophoenician mother made it impossible for these children to come into the truth, Gentiles to the end. Officially, Rehoboam holds the record for the most number of children. I don't know if you knew that. 28 sons and 60 daughters. He had 88 children. But I just want you to think for a second There's no daughters mentioned here. Ahab has at least 70 sons. There's also Ahaziah, Joram, and Athaliah, and no other daughters are mentioned. It's quite possible that Ahab's family was substantially larger again than Rehoboam's. Any chance you think that this king might have been worshipping Baal, the god of fertility? Any chance you think? They're like rabbits. Everywhere, these children. Dozens and dozens and dozens of them. No wonder they have foster parents, as it literally is in verse 1. It's a big job being in the fertility business. And see, this is the world, isn't it? This is the world. The most important job of all, which is raising a godly seed, no, we delegate that to people who really couldn't care less. That's what Ahab did. Foster parents. Raising a godly seed for God was not a priority. And these 70 sons have foster parents who we're going to see tonight were more like hirelings than shepherds. They care more about their own hides than the flocks. Remember what John chapter 10 verse 13 says? They're not shepherds, they're hirelings. And when the wolf comes, the hireling flees, for he careth not for the sheep. And these foster parents were prepared to sacrifice the 70 sons to save their own lives. But for now, the big question that was facing Jehu was, well, how do I get every single last one of these 70 sons as Elijah and Elisha had commanded? Because it was like an impossible mission, wasn't it? There were so many of them, it was hard to know how do we have every single one, because that's his commission and he's driving furiously. Ironically, it was a little bit like the task faced by Athaliah when she was trying to kill out the king's seed. You can't afford to forget one. She obviously did. Her own grandchildren, she forgot one of them. But Jehu is trying to make sure that every last male in Ahab's house is destroyed. How to do such a thing? And then Jehu hits on a solution that was as ironic as it was elegant. It says he wrote letters. Now, remember we said in our last study that this story is filled with moments of irony and poetic justice. When it says Jehu wrote letters, what kind of an echo does that sound in your head? And the answer is 1 Kings chapter 21 and verses 8 to 11. Jezebel, wanting to conspire against Naboth, wrote letters. Oh, and who did she write the letters to? Why, the elders in Jezreel. And Jehu is going to write to the elders in Samaria and Jezreel. Jezebel wrote to organize the secret death of Naboth, and now Jehu is going to wreak vengeance on Ahab's house using his wife's methods. Letters to the same elders. Do you know the word letters occurs four times in 1 Kings chapter 21 and four times here in 2 Kings chapter 10. It's actually all on slide 26 in our handbooks. Let's just go through them very quickly. 1 Kings 21, verse 8. She wrote letters in Ahab's name. Verse 8. Sent the letters unto the elders and to the nobles that were in the city. Verse 9, and she wrote in the letters, saying, proclaim a fast. In verse 11, it was as it was written in the letters which she had sent unto them. And now here, in 2 Kings chapter 10, four times, we're going to have the word letters in this record. Verse 1, verse 2, verse 6, and verse 7. Sent to exactly the same elders. This is poetic indeed, isn't it? On Jehu's behalf. A tribute, you might say. A tribute to Naboth and the justice of God. And the letters said this, verse 2. Now, as soon as this letter cometh to you, seeing your master's sons are with you, and there are with you chariots and horses, a fenced city also in armor, look even out the best and meetest of your master's sons, and set him on his father's throne, and fight for your master's house. Literally, in verse 3, best and meetest is goodliest and fittest. Get the most manly. Get the most kingly. Set them on the throne, says Jehu. It's time to fight. And I think this is another subtle allusion back to Naboth. Because hadn't Jezebel said in 1 Kings 21 and verse 9, set Naboth on high. Set him on high. And now Jehu is going to say, you choose out the best of the sons. Set him on high. Set him on the throne. Fight for your throne. But just remember, says Jehu, just remember that Naboth couldn't stand before two false witnesses. And maybe your sons won't be able to stand either now that two kings are dead. Verse 4. See the irony in this story? Everything is coming back upon the head of Ahab's house. Where are your loyalties, says Jehu. He's forcing and manipulating these men into a position from which they cannot escape. Well, maybe it was a bluff. I wonder if Jehu had actually shown up, they might have just laughed at his pitiful excuse for an army. Just a few followers? You can't carry through on your threats. But he was a military captain. And he knew the value of intimidation and fear and timing. Now, he says, as soon as this letter cometh to you, see the point? There was no time to rally troops. This was a one-off offer for them to pit the royal princes against himself. A winner-takes-all battle. He knew their cowardly, spineless natures. He knew that, put under pressure, they'd never fight back. There's no way they'd fight. You put enough pressure on these men, and they will cave. And we read that in verse 4. But they were exceedingly afraid and said, behold, two kings stood not before him. How then shall we stand? And he that was over the house, and he that was over the city, the elders also, and the bringers up of the children, sent to Jehu, saying, we are thy servants, and we will do whatever you bid us. We will not make any king. Do that which is good in thine eyes. Utter capitulation. Utter submission. Remember we said in our last class, faced with a king who was prepared to stand up against him, Joram, a type of king sin, turned and fled. He was a coward. And these men are just the same. King Sin is ultimately a coward. When faced with serious opposition, it will always put self-preservation first. At any cost. And so now, Jehu puts his proposition. And it is a psychological masterpiece. Look at what he says in verse 6. Then he wrote a letter the second time to them, saying, if ye be mine, and if ye will hearken unto my voice, take ye the heads of the men, your master's sons, and come to me to Jezreel by tomorrow this time. Now the king's sons, being 70 persons, were with the great men of the city, which brought them up. Now I'm hoping that now that your eyes are open to the echoes of poetic justice, you won't have missed the one in verse 6. Maybe you heard it this time. Tomorrow, by tomorrow, this time, 24 hours, a threat of death. It's exactly the expression that Jezebel used in her letter to Elijah in 1 Kings 19 and verse 2. So let the gods do to me and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of the prophets of Baal, by tomorrow about this time. These are the very words of Jezebel, getting fed back into the teeth of Jezebel's sons. This was Jezebel's threat, revisited on her own children's heads. And now there was immense time pressure. You see, it was 25 kilometers from Jezreel to Samaria. And there was no instant communication. They needed to decide instantly. You couldn't send a message very easily to Jezreel and back, or to Samaria and back. 50 kilometers would take a long time to travel. They had to make an instant decision. It's what you might call a true deadline. Now, look how this expression is used through the scriptures. It's slide 27 in our handbooks. Tomorrow, this time. Exodus 9 and verse 18. Behold, tomorrow about this time, I will cause it to rain a very grievous hail. Or Joshua 11 and verse 6. Yahweh said unto Joshua, be not afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time will I deliver them up. Or 1 Samuel 9. Tomorrow about this time I will send thee a man out of the land of Benjamin. Thou shalt anoint him to be captain over my people Israel. And Saul was going to say the same thing. They said unto the messengers that came, tomorrow by that time the sun be hot, ye shall have help. And look at this last one. 2 Kings chapter 7 and verse 1. Then Elisha said, hear ye the word of Yahweh. Tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel, and two measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria. How ironic. The elders of Samaria have heard this phrase before. Just two or three chapters before, at the start of 2 Kings 7. And the last time someone said, tomorrow about this time, somebody died. The Lord of the king who disbelieved the words of Elisha in chapter 7. The irony is everywhere, isn't it? And the lesson is, from this phrase, that our lives can completely change in 24 hours. And we need to remember this. God is in control, and he can work quickly. Let's have faith, brothers and sisters and young people. Let's have faith that he has got our lives in the hollow of his hand. And one day, coming soon, in 24 hours, our lives will be forever changed. It's going to happen. Tomorrow, about this time, that day will come. God will change everything in just a short period of time. And so, faced with the pressure and the manipulation of Jehu's 24-hour deadline, they gave in. And we read this in verse 7. It came to pass, when the letter came to them, that they took the king's sons and slew 70 persons, put their heads in baskets, and sent them to Jezreel. This is King Sin, prepared to sacrifice their own children to save their own hide. Do you know, this is worse than Molech, isn't it? This is worse than Molech. At least with Molech, it was a gift to the gods. Oh, a deluded gift, but a gift to the gods nevertheless. This was all about self-preservation. This was far worse than sacrificing your children to Molech. And did you hear the other echo of poetic justice? Ahab had been cursed because he wanted to substitute Naboth's baskets of grapes with herbs. And now the elders substitute their lives with the baskets of Ahab's sons' heads. It's poetic justice indeed, isn't it, in this story? And now God is bringing Ahab's decisions back on his family's heads. All these overtones back to Naboth. And so we read in verse 8, "And there came a messenger and told him, Jehu, saying, 'They have brought the heads of the king's sons.' And he said, 'Lay ye them in two heaps at the entering in of the gate until the morning.'" And there came a messenger. Do you know, that's exactly the same as 1 Kings chapter 21 and verse 14, where they sent a messenger to Jezebel to say, "Naboth is stoned and is dead." There's irony in every verse here. The messenger is the same, telling of death. Now, I couldn't help but read this verse, and I suppose I'm asking for your thoughts, if you're willing to share them, about this laying in two heaps at the entering in of the gate. I couldn't help reading this verse and wondering whether this was a type of the sacrifice of Christ. 70 heads in two heaps. Now, if you're going to have two heaps, you'd have 35 heads in a basket on this side and 35 heads in a basket on this side. Maybe there's an allusion to possessing the gate of your enemies. But it seemed to me that maybe there's an allusion to the last week of the 70 weeks, remember, which was divided in half to give 2 3.5-day periods. It's the cutting off of Messiah in the middle of the week. Maybe it's an allusion to the three animals of Genesis 15, which were cut in half, and then there was a turtle dove, 7 pieces, 3.5 on this side, if you like, and 3.5 on this side, and Abraham walks in the middle to make the covenant. It seems like there's shadows here of something. So if you've got any thoughts, I would love to hear afterwards. I have my own, but I'd love to hear what you think. Either way, whether there's a type here of the sacrifice of Christ or not, this was an unmistakable way, wasn't it, of both verifying the head count, because you can just count heads, and also simultaneously deterring the rest of the people from further rebellion. There's nothing like baskets of heads to sort of quell opposition. The still warm, grisly, blood-stained heads piled up gruesomely in the sun, right outside the gate of Jezreel. What was right outside the gate of Jezreel, brothers and sisters? Naboth's vineyard. That's exactly where Naboth's sons lay buried, piled outside Naboth's inheritance. This was irony indeed, wasn't it? This is the exquisitely, finely tuned judgments of God. Sons for sons. In exactly the same place, in the portion of Naboth just outside the gate of the city. And we read this in verse 9. "It came to pass in the morning that he went out and stood and said to all the people, 'Ye be righteous. Behold, I conspired against my master and slew him. But who slew all these?'" Do you know, I think what's happening in this verse is that Jehu is making sure that all the elders are firmly implicated in this conspiracy. You could read verse 9 as astonishment, couldn't you? You could read it like, "Well, I conspired against my master and slew him, but I mean, what's happening here? What are all these heads?" Jehu wasn't astonished. He'd asked them to do it. He's making sure in front of all the people that they all know that it's the elders that put these sons to death. They are part of this conspiracy against Ahab's house. They can't get out of it now. If Jehu was conspiring by killing one king, well, this is definitely conspiring to kill 70 of the king's sons. He wants it on record that everyone now, it seems, is supporting his kingship. There would be no self-righteousness or self-defense from his enemies now. They had completely and publicly implicated themselves. And we read this in verse 10. Know now that there shall fall unto the earth nothing of the word of Yahweh, which Yahweh spake concerning the house of Ahab. For Yahweh hath done that which he spake by his servant Elijah. Do you know, this is the third time that Jehu mentions Elijah's words. Chapter 9, verse 26. Chapter 9, verse 36. And now, here, chapter 10 and verse 10. Here's a man who acknowledges Yahweh's providence. This was what Yahweh said would happen. This was exactly what Elijah prophesied. There's a real spiritual dimension to this man. And in actual fact, the words of verse 10 are an allusion, or you might even say a quotation, of the words of Samuel. Just hold your hand here and come back to 1 Samuel. You probably know this, but 1 Samuel chapter 3. In verse 19, Jehu had said, know now that there shall fall unto the earth nothing of the word of Yahweh. Look what Samuel says, or is said of Samuel. In 1 Samuel chapter 3, in verse 19, and Samuel grew, and Yahweh was with him, and did let none of his words fall to the ground. And Jehu's going to quote the words of 1 Samuel 3, verse 19. It was like both Samuel and Jehu didn't let God's promises go astray. They held them up. They held them off the ground from being lost. And just as Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and Eli's dynasty was evil, and Samuel would replace them, now Jehu would replace Joram and Ahaziah and Ahab's dynasty. And his attitude was the same as Samuel's. Yahweh is with me. Yahweh is with me. Which is what Samuel says in this chapter, in 2 Samuel chapter 3. These men were alike. So Jehu wasn't uneducated, was he? Jehu was not just a killing machine. Jehu is quoting the scriptures publicly. None of my arrows are wasted, he's saying. None will fall needlessly to the ground. I am Yahweh's man, and Yahweh is with me. There's a spiritual dimension to this man. And on the back of this confidence-building triumph, where actually, you think about it, Jehu has actually done nothing apart from write some letters. He's managed to get every single last son of the 70 into baskets outside the gate, and he hasn't raised a finger. You can imagine how he must have felt. Man, God is truly with me. This revolution has God's blessing. And now the elders have embroiled themselves inextricably in his revolution. And so we read in verse 11, so on the back of this, Jehu slew all that remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, all his great men and his kinsfolks and his priests, until he left him none remaining. So what do you think happened to the great men of verse 6, who thought that they would save their own hides by sacrificing the 70 sons? Well, it may be in verse 11 that all those great men ended up losing their lives the same day nonetheless. This was a clinical fulfillment of his mission. No distractions, no mistakes, nobody left out. Rotherham says for verse 11, he did not leave remaining a survivor. Now, do you know this is a Bible theme? It is slide 27 in our handbooks. None remained. Look at this. Exodus 14 and verse 28. The waters returned, covered the chariots and the horsemen, and all the hosts of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. There remained not so much as one of them. 100% success in killing Pharaoh's host. Or Deuteronomy chapter 3. So Yahweh our God delivered into our hands Og also, the king of Bashan, and all his people. And we smote him until none was left to him remaining. Or 1 Samuel 11, Saul put the people in three companies. And they, verse 11, slew the Ammonites. It came to pass that they which remained were scattered, so that two of them were not left together. There was not one remaining. It's the spirit of Joshua over and over and over again in Joshua. Chapter 8, verse 22. Chapter 10, verse 28, 30, 33, 37, 39, 40. Chapter 11, verse 8. Nobody was remaining of the Canaanites. 100% success. It's a phrase that captures the completeness of God's victory. There are no loose ends. Sin is absolutely and completely destroyed. Not just 99%. 100% destroyed. This is our hope. We're not hoping, brothers and sisters, to get into the kingdom and be 99% fixed. 100% perfection. This was what is being hinted at in this phrase. And I wonder if Jehu isn't picking up the spirit of Joshua consciously. As Joshua destroyed the Canaanites, now Jehu would destroy the infiltration of Canaanite and Tyrian idolatry into Yahweh's people. He would not rest until there was none remaining. He could see the parallels. Maybe Jehu felt like he was fulfilling the spirit of Joshua. And now the nobles and priests that were involved in the innocent murder of Naboth in 1 Samuel chapter 21 and verse 8 are going to be rounded up and slaughtered. No one's going to escape. All of Ahab's household, nephews, princes, both in Jezreel, verse 11, and in Samaria, verse 17. Now, if you've got slide 28, our genealogy again, I would kill her children with death. We're talking about the sons in Jezreel and Samaria that were killed by Jehu in verse 11 and 17. So two generations straight under Ahab and Jezebel. So Jehu's having success, isn't he? Everywhere he goes, Ahab's house is being exterminated. And so we come to the last few verses for our class this evening, and the killing of the 42 princes, which you'll see is right down the bottom in the middle. These are the great-grandchildren of Ahab and Jezebel, or Ahaziah's nephews. Now, as you can see from this slide, if you've got slide 28 in front of you, actually Ahaziah's older brothers to the left have already been killed by the Arabians in 2 Chronicles chapter 22 and verse 1. So when it talks about Ahaziah's brethren, it's not his brothers, they're already dead. 2 Chronicles 22 verse 1. It must have been their children, Ahab's great-grandsons. In fact, 2 Chronicles 22 and verse 8 says quite clearly they were the sons of the brethren of Ahaziah. They're probably just teenagers, maybe not even that. They've got people who are looking after them. And it seems like they're traveling up from Jerusalem in verse 12. They live in Judah to the south to catch up with Uncle Joram. So let's just read these verses together. 2 Kings 10 and verse 12 to 14. And he arose and departed and came to Samaria. And as he was at the shearing house, in the way Jehu met with the brethren of Ahaziah, king of Judah, and said, "Who are ye?" And they answered, "We are the brethren of Ahaziah, and we go down to salute the children of the king and the children of the queen." And he said, "Take them alive." And they took them alive and slew them at the pit of the shearing house, even 42 men, neither left he any of them. Now it seems like these men, travelling up from Jerusalem, have no idea about the chaos and the carnage of Jehu's revolution and what's happening in the northern kingdom. They're coming up to visit Joram and Ahaziah as they're convalescing. They're already dead, of course, back in chapter 9. But there are no text messages back in these days. There's no instant communication. These men are completely ignorant. So this is telling us how fast Jehu has moved. He's killed Jehoram. The next day, he kills Ahaziah. The next day, Jezebel's dead. The next day, he's going to say or threaten the 70 sons. The next day, they're dead. So the revolution has only taken a few days. And these young men are completely ignorant of what has been happening. They're the last group of Ahab's male relatives. And again, just like Ahaziah, they fall right into into Jehu's lap. This is what Josephus says in the Antiquities. He says this: "They replied that they came to salute Joram and their own king Ahaziah, for they knew not that he had slain them both." So Jehu had moved quickly and they hadn't heard. So as it happens, Jehu, he doesn't even have to travel into Judah to execute his judgments on the southern kingdom and Ahab's descendants in the south. Ahaziah and Ahaziah's 42 nephews just show up right into Ahab's path in Samaria. This was God at work, wasn't it? This was God's work, God's judgments. Do you know, some have suggested that this is Jehu dabbling in the southern kingdom where he never should have been. And they say, some commentators, that this precipitates a catastrophe in the southern kingdom where Athaliah steps into the vacuum of power and almost extinguishes the line of Messiah. And they almost blame Jehu for overstepping his job description and the horrific repercussions that may have come. We understand, don't we, that God had all of that in hand. He had Athaliah well in hand. I think we've established last time that actually Jehu is commended for carrying out God's instructions to the letter. The female Athaliah was not his brief. And I think that here in this story, we have the divine answer. God delivers the Judean part of Ahab's dynasty right into Jehu's lap. See the margin? See the margin? It says, "They were found by him." Just like chapter 9 and verse 21 says, they went out against Jehu and met or found him in the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite. Now these men find Jehu. This is God's arrangement and timing. These were the last few remaining male members of the dynasty, albeit from Judah by marriage, but not forgotten by Jehu. And they've come up. See what the margin says? They've come up to, oh, here it is again, seek the peace of Joram and Ahaziah. This is a family that wants peace without righteousness. There could be no peace for this family, despite their desire for it at all costs. Remember the words of Joram and Jezebel? Is it peace? Is it peace? And Jehu says, kill them. 42 men who should have been the future shepherds of the southern kingdom but who are more like wolves in sheep's clothing. And here they are delivered to the slaughterhouse. And actually it turns out, Jehu was the shepherd, and they were the sheep. And they were found to be blemished, covered in sores and lame. Instead of being shorn, they were sacrificed by the judge. They were rotten and unacceptable. And the irony was, they were killed at a shearing house, the very place where coats and coverings were generated. But there would be no covering for these men. They were blemished and unforgiven, cursed by God. Do you know, it's very interesting to look at the three instances where shearing has cropped up in the scriptures up until now. It's slide 29 in our handbooks, the shearing house. Only three times has shearing sheep occurred in the scriptures up until this point. Genesis 31, verses 19 to 20. And Laban went to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the images that were her father's, and Jacob stole away unawares to Laban the Syrian, in that he told him not that he fled. There was secrecy, deceit, and idolatry associated with shearing in Genesis 31. What about Genesis 38? And was told Tamar, saying, "Behold, thy father-in-law goeth up to Timnath to shear his sheep." And she put her widow's garments off from her, and covered her with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place, which is by the way to Timnath. And we know exactly what happened in Genesis 38. Immorality at the time of shearing. Or what about 1 Samuel 25? There was a man in Maon whose possessions were in Carmel. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal and the name of his wife Abigail, but the man was churlish and evil in his doings. He's a fool. And shearing, it seems, is associated almost, well, up until this point, always with evil. It's idolatry, it's deceit, it's immorality, it's foolishness. Almost as if to say, shearing the lamb is not enough to cover sin. Shearing is not the principle of Genesis 3. Shearing is not the principle of Hebrews 9, verse 22. Without the shedding of blood, there can be no remission of sin. And Rachel, Judah, and Nabal all thought maybe that they were safe, hiding under a lamb's wool covering. But it wasn't enough. It was just a shorn coat, not a sacrificed one. And maybe the lesson is that a lamb's fleece without sacrifice is an unacceptable disguise. And these royal sons should have been covered. They came from the southern kingdom of Judah, the line of Messiah. They should have been covered by a true coat of skins, a proper lambskin generated by a sacrifice and the shedding of blood. For without it, there was no forgiveness. And Jehu says, "Kill them. They're of Ahab's house. They're uncovered. They're condemned by God. There would be no hiding here. No disguises that could rescue them from Jehu's sword." And in the pit, they were all dispatched. And so with these men, every last descendant of the house of Ahab has been killed, exactly as God asked. And do you know, from this point in the record, in Chronicles, the Chronicles record from 2 Chronicles 22 on is going to switch from tracing Israel in the north, it's going to switch to tracing Judah in the south. It abandons Jehu's reign and instead traces the survival of Messiah's line. The northern kingdom had effectively been rescued by Jehu. Every last male of Ahab's house had been ruthlessly hunted down. The northern kingdom was rescued. His commission was complete. All of Ahab's descendants and Jezebel's descendants were gone. This was in every way Jehu the judge. And as we finish this class, I want to just introduce to you the type in the story. We're going to develop this a little bit more further, probably in our last class, but here's what's happening behind the story here in 1st and 2nd of Kings. And I hope that you'll find this interesting. It's slide 30 in our handbooks. How do these three men work together in portraying the work of Christ? Well, Elijah was that brusque prophet from the wilderness who stormed into Ahab's house and confronted the apostasy. And Elijah is going to give rise to Elisha. And Elisha's name means Yah is salvation. He does twice as many miracles as Elijah. He has a double portion of the Spirit. But Elisha is more concerned with teaching and miracles and healing and saving. There's no record of the sword of Elisha in that sense. And then we have Jehu. And what's Jehu known for? Driving furiously and bringing God's unerring judgments and vengeance upon the apostasy for their lack of repentance. And I'm going to suggest to you that in these three men, we have why John the Baptist, we know that Elijah is a type of John the Baptist. We know that Elisha, Yah is salvation, is a type of our Lord Jesus Christ. And I'm going to suggest that the mission or the ministry of Elisha, seeking out to save and heal and work miracles, work with the people, was the first advent of Christ. But Jehu is also going to be a type of Christ, but he's going to be a type of Jesus Christ in his second advent, coming to bring judgment upon the apostasy. So Elisha and Jehu are really the two advents of the one man. Elisha was the son of who? Shaphat. And Jehu was the son of Jehoshaphat. The first to convert and heal and teach the people. The second to judge the apostasy and bring God's justice and vengeance. And that's why when we piece together the record of 2 Kings, we're going to find that patterns emerge surrounding these two men. Now, I don't know if as we read 2 Kings chapter 10, and I'm going to say particularly verse 14, your mind sprang to some other passage. But if it did, or even if it didn't, hopefully you'll agree with what we might suggest now. It's slide 31 in our handbooks. Because what's going to happen is in the first few chapters of 2 Kings, chapters 2 to 8, we're going to have the work of Elisha. And in chapters 9 and 10, the work of Jehu. And we're going to find remarkable parallels between these two men. They're both types of Christ. And the point in the record is they're both doing the same things. So look at this. When we come across Jehu in 2 Kings chapter 9, we meet him when a son of the prophets pours oil on his head behind shut doors. Do you know, we've read exactly the same thing in 2 Kings chapter 4. There was a son of the prophets who got all the vessels in the city and poured out oil behind closed doors, as Elisha said. Exactly the same things has happened already in chapter 4, verses 2 to 6. In chapter 5, there's the story of Naaman. He's a Syrian captain. And he's healed and converted. When we come to chapter 9, we're going to have Israel's captain promoted And we maybe say, is he converted? Time will tell. In chapter 9 and verse 20, Jehu is in his chariot driving furiously. And in chapter 4, we read of a woman on an ass that slacked not her riding. You can imagine her, giddy up, go! Her son was dying. She's driving furiously to find Elisha. In chapter 8 and verse 6, there's a eunuch who's going to restore the Shunammite woman's fortunes. And in chapter 9, there's going to be two eunuchs who kill a Zidonian woman, Jezebel. Oh, this is the same, isn't it? This is the same story. Jezebel was trampled underfoot in Jezreel in chapter 9, verse 33. But what do we read in chapter 7 and verse 18 to 20? Why, the Lord or the captain of Samaria, who did not believe, was trampled underfoot in the gate of the city. Oh, there's parallels here, isn't there, in these two parts of the record of 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 10, there were nourishers, these great men who brought up the 70 sons, who killed their own children, their own foster children. Chapter 10, verses 1 to 8, well, that's already happened in 2 Kings chapter 6. Mothers were killing their own children. We'll boil my son tonight and eat him, and then we'll boil your son tomorrow night. Mothers eating their own children. In chapter 6, the king threatens to remove Elisha's head. And in 2 Kings chapter 10, Jehu does just that to the head of the 70 of the king's sons. Here's the one that started me off on this, and maybe I'm hoping you saw this. 42 young princes of Judah slain? Why, that's got to be paralleled, hasn't it, to the 42 youths slain for cursing Elisha in 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 23 to 26. The princes who were slain in the pit by the sheep shearing house are going to have their counterpart in chapter 3. Mesha was a king of Moab. He's a sheep master. He paid in wool, and all the men of Moab were killed in ditches or pits. And lastly, Elisha is going to bring life by putting mouth upon mouth in chapter 4 and verse 34. And we're going to come tomorrow to the story of how Jehu brought death to all those who were in the temple of Baal. And if you haven't seen that before in verse 21 of chapter 10, it says in the margin that the house of Baal was full from one end to the other. And in the margin it says, so full that they were mouth to mouth. It's the same expression as when Elisha put his mouth upon the mouth of the child. What's happening here in 2 Kings 2 to 8 and 2 Kings 9 to 10? And I think what we're being told is both of these men, Elisha and Jehu, are doing the exact same things. See the parallel? Because they're both Christ. They're both Christ in the record. Isn't that fascinating? The watermarks are all the same. And sitting in behind the story are all these parallels to tell us that these two men, Elisha and Jehu, are really the same man, Christ. But despite the similarities, which are unmistakable, they will enact two different advents. And I wonder whether that's maybe an answer to our question, why Elijah only anoints Elisha in the providence of God. I think maybe Elijah knew that he was to anoint the man who was the still small voice. And he obviously talked to Elisha and said, you are going to need to anoint Hazael and Jehu in God's timing. And God will let you know. He's always let me know what to do. He will let you know. And Elisha anoints Hazael and Jehu when God tells him to do that. But Elisha's ministry is going to come first, because Elisha is the first advent of Christ. And when Elisha anoints Jehu, or sends the son of the prophets to anoint Jehu, we're going to find that Elisha fades, steps back in the record. Oh, do you know, Elisha is still alive for another 30 to 40 years. Elisha's not dead here in chapters 9 and 10, but Elisha is the first advent of Christ. And now chapters 9 and 10 is the second advent, and Elisha is going to take a back seat, step back into the shadows. Elisha comes first, and then Jehu. But think about the implications. Jehu is Christ in this story. He's bringing God's judgments on an apostate, idolatrous world. He's not making mistakes. He's not going too far. God is delivering these men into his hand. He doesn't even have to travel into Judah. Yahweh is he, son of Yahweh's judgments. We need to have absolute confidence, brothers and sisters and young people, that God has the affairs of the world in hand. So what are our take-home messages from our class tonight? Well, I think the first might be the relentless determination of Jehu. He didn't give up when he'd slain two kings and Jezebel, when the job was 80% done. He didn't want any of God's words left to fall to the ground. And we've got to ask ourselves, are we enduring unto the end to be saved? Are we determined to fulfill our commission right to the finish? Hebrews 6 verse 11 says, "And we desire that every one of you do show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope unto the end." Jehu was a man who saw out his mission to the end. He drove furiously. He wasn't going to stop until he had fulfilled God's mission. We can maybe learn from this man. What about tackling the smaller sins? Do we stop at just removing the big evils in our lives? Or do we also have a strategy to uproot the smaller and the less obvious character flaws? What about the little things? What about the little changes we need to make? The little bad habits? The less glaring faults? Are we working on rooting out the whole house of Ahab from our lives? Or just the two big kings and Jezebel? And lastly, this is a good lesson, isn't it? Jehu worked quickly. Sin was confronted quickly. Do we tackle sin quickly in our lives, or do we procrastinate? You know, when Jehu confronted Jezebel, he didn't say, "All right, well, come down and let's have a chat." He didn't say that. He's not bargaining with that woman. He's confronting sin and overtaking her and putting her to death. He didn't prevaricate. He didn't mess around. Ecclesiastes 8 verse 11 says, "Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil." And Jehu didn't procrastinate. Once he was anointed, he moved swiftly. So swiftly that the 42 young men were caught completely unawares. And sometimes I think, brothers and sisters, in our lives, we allow sin to gather its forces, to marshal its troops, to amass its strongest defense. And then we wonder why it is so difficult to overcome. Let's learn from this story to tackle sins more quickly in our lives, because maybe then we can be more like Jehu and our Lord Jesus Christ. Verse 14, "Neither left he any of them." Let's take these lessons to heart as we ponder the relentless drive of this determined chariot driver who drove furiously for God.